Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
Decision has sent shockwaves through the legal community.
The United States continues to move towards a post-Roe world after the right to abortion was overturned by the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court spent about 100 years developing a line of case law that said you have the right to privacy.
The court's majority opinion is focused on a strict constitutional interpretation.
During the election year of 1868, the scallywag was accused of inciting blacks and giving them the idea that they deserved social equality. The so-called freedmen, one angry journalist blasted, were now the slaves of the scallywag white trash. He violated social norms by mixing freely with blacks in public and private places. He invited the black man home to dinner, wounding the sensibility of his proper wife. And yet this worthless, ill-bred creature had suddenly acquired power. The very traits they despised in him, his low-class ways, his willingness to commingle with blacks, made him the perfect party operative. In a volatile election year, the scallywag's racial and class pedigree both became issues.
Way out in the morning sun, there lies my baby, she was waiting. She was waiting so impatiently. Oh, Lord, what a sweet man.
Saying we're no longer going to look at privacy rights based on our current understanding of what privacy rights are. We're only going to look at rights that existed at the time the amendments were passed.
A brilliant piece of Democratic propaganda was The Autobiography of a Scallywag. The protagonist, John Stubbs, had been born to a poor family of 14 in Shiflett's Corner, Virginia, a community known for lowlifes and criminals. Joining the Confederate Army, he slid from an artillery posting to teamster to cleaning Jefferson Davis's stables. He had no ambition for honor or glory. His wartime trajectory was predictably downward. Deserting, Stubbs lied to the Yankees that he was a Union man. Returning to Virginia in 1866, he became a scallywag and found he had a talent for nigger speaking. He defended Negro suffrage not on any high-principled stand, but on his low-down motto, "Every man for himself." Stubbs knew that carpetbaggers had no respect for him, but he didn't care, as long as a generous supply of whiskey accompanied their snubs. He was rewarded with a county clerk position, without having to improve himself. In his unsentimental journey up the Republican ladder, he learned that his rascality was increasingly tolerated as he rose in the world.
Missouri's Constitution still provides that marriage is a union between one man and one woman. Kansas still has anti-sodomy laws on the books saying that consensual same-sex relationships between people of the same sex are illegal. A lot of people in the United States do not have $3,000 to $10,000 of what would be a discretionary expense or something that's not part of their regular budget. So, there's a very real human impact here.
In Kansas City, Dan Cohen, KSHB 41 News.
There are some free resources if you'd like to execute powers of attorney like the estate planning you just heard about. We have links for those resources in Kansas and Missouri on our website, kshb.com.
I think the tools of surveillance are constantly increasing, and the same tools will apply in these cases as in other cases. So, you know, what does the Fourth Amendment mean anyway is obviously a question every public defender contends with. And the police will search people's cell phones illegally, and they will use data of searches that they did on the internet. You know, we have cases where looking for resources online about abortions during a pregnancy is then used as evidence in a trial as sort of ambivalence of carrying that pregnancy to term, and therefore evidence of potentially having self-managed abortions. And so I think one needs to be really, really concerned about privacy, how we will have our privacy rights sort of consistently violated as they have been for anyone that's been criminalized. I think the additional piece that I would love to say is that, you know, if you live in New York, you hear on the subway, they say, "See something, say something." And maybe that's not your specific city, but there is this idea that with abortion, that we should be reporting our loved ones, that the surveillance will come from within us, that we will be surveilling and reporting each other and ourselves. And I think that's the kind of surveillance that I'm most concerned about, where the most marginalized, vulnerable folks in our communities that have experienced the most trauma can't rely on the safety of their communities and their providers to care for them, and instead should be afraid of them because they could be the reason that they're reported, or they could be the people surveilling them. And I think that's what the sculpture of abortion stigma really does. And that's the kind of surveillance that I'm also in, you know, really, really concerned about. But absolutely, I think there's services like Delete Me that allow you to delete your data on the internet. Strongly recommend doing that. Strongly recommend talking to the Digital Defense Fund and seeing what is an option and what folks should do to protect their privacy. There's an app like YouKey. But I think even if you didn't make all of those specific shifts, really understanding that the things you talk about publicly, that the things that are on the internet about you, your searches, etc., your text messages, all the things that cops usually do, they will do in these cases.
The scallywag was the Democrats' version of white trash. Just ask ex-Confederate Colonel Wade Hampton, who in 1868 was still 8 years from being elected governor of South Carolina. He was a hero of the Redeemers, whose movement ultimately toppled Republican rule in the southern states, and he must be credited with the most memorable insult of all, as his words traveled all the way to England. Knowing his husbandry, Hampton invoked the best-known usage of scallywag as vagabond stock, used by drovers to describe the mean, lousy, and filthy kind that are not fit for butchers or dogs. The scallywag was human waste with an unnatural ambition. He was biologically unfit, and at the same time a skilled operative who stirred the scum and thrived in the muck.
Don't you know who is talking to you? Is the man with the song to you? So make a move, get right up and sing.
Reconstruction era ended, so-called men of inherited worth were returned to political power across the South. In the 1880s, the white North and South reconnected. The redeemed cracker became a hard-working farmer, while others praised the unsullied mountaineer, both capable of education and having risen enough that they would no longer be a burden on the Southern economy. For a brief moment, reconciliation stories were popular, and previously warring sides in the national drama entertained bright prospects for domestic harmony. Cracker Joe, 1883, was written by a New Englander. The title character's story was set in Florida and used love and forgiveness to overcome past wrongs and resentments. Joe, a born cracker, runs a successful farm. He defies his heritage by exhibiting shrewd ambition. He is a go-ahead man, an avid reader with a phenomenal memory. He calls his wife, Luce, the whitest woman, soul, and body I ever did see, suggesting that he is not quite white, but only a cracker, you know. Like the family in Harriet Beecher Stowe's Dread, Joe is a half-breed, his mother of good blood.
I really appreciate Rafa's advice about checking out the Digital Defense Fund. They are a team of organizers, engineers, designers, abortion fund, and practical support volunteers who do digital security work for the abortion access movement. There are slide decks available on their website, and they also offer trainings and consultations. Government surveillance and right-wing infiltration and attacks, including digital attacks, are a very real concern right now. Take advantage of the resources that are out there. Secure your communications. Make a personal digital security plan. Start using an encrypted texting app like Signal. The government doesn't need to know who you are meeting at a protest or who you are meeting for coffee. Encrypt it all and take whatever precautions you can when it comes to preserving your privacy in these times. I also appreciated Rafa's focus on interpersonal surveillance and the threat that it poses. A climate that makes people afraid to express fear or uncertainty about a pregnancy because someone might report them or submit evidence against them tears at the very fabric of our communities. The idea that the people we turn to in a crisis could betray us or leave us at the mercy of the state is destabilizing and isolating, particularly for people grappling with potentially life-changing news. Fear and paranoia these laws foment serve as a form of punishment for sex and pregnancy, and also as a form of social control, because it further atomizes the people it subjugates, making them increasingly vulnerable to both state and interpersonal violence. These dynamics also empower abusive partners whose victims self-manage abortions or experience miscarriages. It is not uncommon for abusive partners whose victims try to leave them to make vengeful, false reports about people to Child Protective Services, because the state stands ready to scrutinize and assume the worst of Black, brown, and impoverished mothers. The state's violence in the form of child removal and other interference is available to those who opt to direct it. We should expect to see similar dynamics around interpersonal surveillance as it relates to abortion or supposed evidence of a person's state of mind around abortion. How can we address this? Well, for one thing, we need to build strong networks of support for people to turn to, not only when they are being abused, but also when they get news of an unwanted pregnancy. When people do not feel safe telling anyone about a pregnancy, they are more likely to forego health care. Most deaths resulting from pregnancy and childbirth are preventable. And yet, the maternal mortality rate in the U.S. increased by nearly 20% from 2019 to 2020. In a climate where people may not trust medical providers or the people around them, people who are at risk of complications are less likely to get the care they may need to survive their pregnancies. To address this, we need to build bonds and networks of trust within our communities that insulate people from the state rather than exposing them. We also need to make resource maps. Who are the abortion doulas or other safe listeners that a pregnant person can discuss options with? Who are the most trustworthy healthcare providers in a given area? Who are least likely to report suspicions of a self-managed abortion or otherwise engage with the state? How can we safely share that information with those who need it? These are questions people are grappling with in states where abortion has now become completely inaccessible. Thank you for listening to Movement Memos. This show wouldn't exist if it weren't for Truth Out. And Truth Out's independent news and commentary wouldn't exist without listeners and readers like you. We have no paywalls, no corporate sponsors, and no ads, except for fundraising appeals like this one. So if you can and would like to support our work, please consider dropping by truthout.org to make a donation today.
Widely circulated bureau reports claimed that hundreds of thousands of destitute whites lived off Uncle Sam's rations. The typical recipients were women covered in rags and filth and a dozen greasy and dirty little innocent prattlers in train.
She creaked down the lane as sane as you make her. Rachel proudly in her hand.
Agreed that the destitution of white refugees, now beggars, dependents, houseless, and homeless wanderers, was as significant as that of the freedmen. In Alabama, Arkansas, Missouri, and Tennessee, the Bureau extended twice, and in some cases, four times as much relief to whites as to blacks. In Georgia, nearly 180,000 white refugees secured food and provisions. As Republican Congressman Green Clay Smith of Kentucky noted during the debate to extend the Freedmen's Bureau in 1866, there are a large number of white people who never owned a foot of land, who never have been in possession of any property, not even a cow or a horse, yet who have been as true and devoted loyalists.
Thank you.
bottom tier, then, Johnson placed free blacks and freed slaves, the latter emancipated, in fact, yet treated as resident aliens, bearing rights, but still denied the franchise. The plan Lincoln's unloved successor had in mind was not a restoration of the old order, nor did it promise to establish a democracy. Instead, it offered America something entirely original. So let us call the Johnson plan what it would have been if actually undertaken, a white trash republic.
You know, Brazil loves a mom between two people is a beautiful thing. Oh, but wait. Let me say, love between three people is an even more beautiful thing, especially if one of them is me.
Was coined for the cognitive elite, aristogenic, what we would call a genetic leadership class. One was once again born to a station, as in the traditional meaning of aristocracy, but it was not because of family name or wealth. Now it was the endowment of inborn qualities that marked off the superior class.
Thank you.
thank you. That's called Love is Pain.
Professor William McDougall at Harvard came up with an equally radical solution. He called for a breeding colony of Eugenia, a separate protectorate within the United States in which the best and brightest would propagate a superior stock. Eugenia would be at once a university and a stud farm. Raised as aristocrats in the tradition of noblesse oblige, the products of the special colony would go out into the world as skilled public servants.
This is called Hard to Grow Up.
It should seem odd to us that the high tide of eugenics coexisted with the storied glamour of the Roaring Twenties, Lindbergh's transatlantic flight, lighthearted flappers, and unpoliced speakeasies. Yet even the flappers were warned that their daring dancing style too closely resembled the ways of those who had gypsy, i.e. black, blood. They would be better served to settle down with a eugenically suitable mate. If ever there was time when class consciousness sank deep roots, this was it. The 1920s saw social exclusiveness masquerade as science, and disdain for rural backwardness and the mongrel taint intensify. In a culture under siege, white trash meant impure and not quite white. Like the moron who somehow passed into the middle class, the ill-bred bastard gave a watchful people a new set of social hazards to look out for, while they listened to the stock ticker and marched off a cliff with the market crash in 1929.
An album called Sinner. It's about stripping away your mask and what is underneath. The song is called Naked.
Thank you. Everything I know, my understanding is they did not witness the assault in front of their face.
They did. I was there.
So the Boston police, the mayor, the U.S. attorney Rachel Rollins, and the FBI all claim they are working together to stop Patriot Front. They also claim that they were unaware of Patriot Front's activities. Multiple media outlets, including the Boston Globe, have spread this state propaganda despite the fact that the police and the Globe were on the ground and the police were quite literally informing us of Patriot Front's activities.
I don't know. My name is Nick. I'm with the Boston Globe. The conductor confirmed that they did leave on the Oak Grove train. Several of the transit police have also confirmed that that the train is being delayed. The transit cop up there.
Say again? Do you know what's happening other than that?
Oh, yeah, I'll call
for it. Okay. Oh, we've read the Boston Herald. I'm not going to say any more than that, but we're familiar with their publication.
No, that was a state cop.
I'll just clarify one thing. A liar I'm not, okay?
In this photo, the man in the checkered shirt, who appears to be FBI Special Agent Stephen Kimball, inspects the contents of Patriot Front's U-Haul just outside of Back Bay Station. Still, U.S. Attorney Rollins claims that they can't go after Patriot Front because Oak Grove Station is some kind of sovereign nation they apparently don't have jurisdiction over.
Come on, guys. What's up with your white nationalist shit?
This should be an enormous scandal, but not a whisper.
You're full of shit! Full of shit!
Quentin Lucas now decides that we need mounted police to return. Now, I thought this was a guy who was actively working to defund the cops. Now all of a sudden he wants more cops and he wants them on horses. What's that all about? Here to talk about it is Kansas City Councilwoman Heather Hall, who we reached out for clarification on this. Maybe she can help us with some perspective. I'm very confused, Councilwoman. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Chris, for having me on. You know, I think you're not the only one who's very confused. If we just do a tiny little bit of a timeline and go back in history, we're at 1975 levels of staffing. 1975, that was a long time ago. Some of your listeners may not have been alive then, and we have people at the levels of police officers in a city with 319 square miles. If you'll remember with me, a little over a year ago, the mayor decided to defund the police department at $42 million, he and several of my colleagues. Well, then, not only did he take the $42 million away, the governor and legal counsel said, wait. They sued him. The governor won. They had to give back the $42 million. And then Senator Luke Kemeyer and others and Doug Ritchie and those folks at the State House wrote a bill that said we need to raise the cap from 20% to 25% minimum of the general fund of Kansas City, Missouri to go to KCPD. And now, right after he signed that bill a week and a half ago, the mayor said, there's potentially going to be lawsuits pending. Now, of course, it was kind of a thread in his tweet, but it was very evident that he said lawsuits will be coming. Furious and unfoundedly furious, because since I've been in office over 7 years, we've never funded the police at less than 25% anyway. So this wasn't going to take 5% away from a different department. This is money we're already giving them just to keep them status quo.
So he shows up after a violent weekend and a crime-ridden weekend in Power and Light, by the way, which, Councilwoman, I'll ask again. I said this yesterday. Maybe I'm overstating it.
Well, I'm not sure where his head is in this, so I'm not going to propose that I know what he's thinking because I don't understand it. What I do understand is math, and I do have an understanding that if you want to reinstate the mounted patrol, which sounds like a lovely, very romantic idea, everybody loves the mounted patrol. They have a presence that is unmatched, no question. However, you don't get to go and say, I'm going to go do mounted patrol. Oh, by the way, we don't have enough officers to do the basic services. Mounted patrol is a very expensive proposition. It's something I want. It's something I think that the city needs and deserves. But it's not just about the officer and the horse. It's about the annual upkeep, feeding, maintaining of those horses. It's not a cheap proposition. So if he wants to defund us, he wants to go back to 20%, he wants that, and he wants this at the same time. You cannot have both at the same time. You've got to pick. And I'm sorry, that's a big person thing to have to do, but he's going to have to pick.
What does that mean mathematically if he chooses to go forward with this and the council approves it? I mean, are you talking about an increased budget from where you are presently, I assume?
Oh, my gosh. This 25% doesn't do anything, Chris. All it does is say, we're keeping it status quo. It's not even really all the money that the police department need to do all the things they need to do just to get staffing levels at the bare minimum for those funny things called the NFL draft and the World Cup. Nobody's acting like that's a big deal. It's a big deal when you don't have enough officers to do what we need on a daily basis. But what about when we bring in the NFL draft, when we bring in the World Cup? And to your point earlier, we bring all these people in and then we send them to crime-ridden places that shouldn't be crime-ridden.
Kansas City always operated, I thought, a little differently, and I think it was largely because Kansas City's police force didn't answer to the radical left that runs the city. I always thought that was to our benefit, but it still seems that the politics of the day have effectively, like so many other police forces across the country, and it's not a knock on our fine men and women who do the work, but it's clearly eroded their ability to do their work too, and crime seems to be on the uptick in a city where it just really wasn't that common, at least not in, certainly not in our premier destinations. And when it reaches those places, I don't know about you, but that starts to feel a little more desperate and dire for the entirety of the city. Is that too much?
Because for a while, even in the last year and a half, even with all of COVID and all of the civil unrest that was happening and all the fleeing of police officers, most areas of crime had gone down. The violent crime had gone up, but most of the other basic areas of crime had been driving down, which was a good thing. So I'm not sure I can answer that intelligently just yet, but I will say that you don't get to, the mayor or anybody, decide to just go ahead and add that in. And I don't know if you remember this because you may not have been here then, but, you know, when they took away the Mounted Patrol for financial reasons, the mayor was on the Board of Police Commissioners. He had a vote in that. So, you know, that's a conversation. It's not like he's confused about it. He was involved with that as a member of the Board of Police Commissioners. So he knows what it costs, and he can't act like he doesn't. He has a budget. He sees a budget every week for the police department. He knows what it costs to do these kinds of things. So I don't know where he expects the money to come from.
Yeah. Do you have reason to believe, was there anything to my thinking that he was either auditioning or being kind of considered for some sort of national post? Was the Biden administration or the Democrat Party sort of interested in him, or do you think they are? Can you read that?
I can't tell you whether they're interested. I mean, I would assume, as an up-and-coming political person, I would assume he has an interest in that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine he wouldn't. But, you know, after you defund the police, and then I went to an event last March with the president, President Biden even lucidly said, we're not defunding the police, we're defending the police. And he said it out loud, and I was in the same room with him. So if you're not walking down that path, even with the president in his current state, then I don't know why he's not. I don't know what he's doing. Well, you know, Chris, last week he decided to kind of have this happen out of nowhere. It was a same-day adoption. He needed 9 council people to vote with him in order to pass it, and he did get 9 people to vote with him. There were 2 of us who voted no.
He's good at that.
And
he seems to do that a lot, doesn't he, these secret kind of sudden votes?
Yeah, maybe it looked sudden to you and me, but I bet it wasn't to them. So first and foremost, I'm just going to say the government needs to stay out of my private medical decisions. I don't care what those decisions are. You as a government should not be involved with what I do. And so that's my statement, and that's the main reason for voting no. From this perspective, number one, we have great benefits. We have 5,000 employees, and we have great medical coverage already. Number two, we have flexible accounts, which you can put up to $2,500 in a flexible account and spend that for things that aren't covered by our insurance. And number three, we already currently in Kansas City, in the metro, Kansas City on the ATA side and on the Joe, on the Kansas City, Johnson, on the Johnson County, Kansas side, we have free transit. So my question is, it's about 15, 20 miles probably from my house to that site over in Kansas where they could get an abortion. What's the $300? How's that magical and what does that pay for? Because if you can get free transit there, I don't know what we're paying for.
Yeah, I don't even know. I mean, I honestly don't know what an abortion costs. What's the going rate for that? Is $300 going to cover that? I don't know. I honestly don't know. But where does it come from? Where would the funds come from?
Well, that's the question I asked. And of course, instead of telling us where they came from, he decided to write it as a resolution instead of an ordinance, which means he's directing the city manager. He's saying, now you go figure it out.
But
either way you slice it, Chris, the money is taxpayer dollars. And I believe that's wise in the face of what we are allowed to do. So, again, an ordinance or a resolution that we have passed, not me, but our council passed, that, again, is going to be illegal from the Missouri State Constitution. And so we're going to have to go back anyway, and they're going to have to take it away. So I don't know why they keep doing these things. It's this political maneuvering because they know they really can't do it, but they're like, well, we tried.
Yeah, you can assume that I guess the state will probably sue over something like this, I would guess. Maybe I'm wrong, but anyway, we'll wait and see on that.
Well, sue or not, it's still illegal. I mean, it's something we can't do.
Right. Let me pivot briefly to the notion of a downtown ballpark with the Royals.
The Jukes, 1877, which proved the most enduring chronicle of a degenerate lineage, and which influenced Charles Davenport, the leading American eugenicist of the early 20th century. The author of the 1868 Putnam's piece claimed to have discovered a real couple with an actual name, thus going beyond Daniel Hundley's more general dismissal of Southern rubbish as the heirs of indentured servants dumped in the American colonies. ¶¶ the author, the only cure for white trash had to be a radical one, intervention. Take a child out of his family's hovel and place him in an asylum, where he might at least learn to work and avoid producing more inbred offspring. The genealogical link had to be cut. As we can see, the line from delinquency to eugenic sterilization was growing shorter. The idea that white trash was a measure of evolutionary progress, or lack thereof, was so pervasive in the 19th century that it conditioned the reception of the first federal study of soldiers. The U.S. Sanitary Commission undertook a major statistical study of some 16,000 men who had served in the Union and Confederate armies. Only a small percentage of them were non-white, approximately 3,000 black men and 519 Indians. When the study was published in 1869, a surgeon who had served in the Union Army queried in the prestigious London Anthropological Review whether it was possible to draw conclusions about racial differences unless researchers actually compared blacks and poor whites. The low-down people may have come from Anglo-Saxon stock, but they had degenerated into an idle, ignorant, and physically and mentally degraded people. It was time to see whether intelligence was a racially specific inherited trait or not. Mongrel was not the only threat Democrats perceived. The emerging cross-sectional opposition party named two more symbolic enemies, carpetbaggers and scallywags. Here is how the new narrative went. When ill-bred men of suspect origins assumed power, virtue in government declined. The despised mudsill of the Civil War era was succeeded by the post-war Yankee invader. The carpetbagger, a rapacious adventurer feeding off the prostrate South, could be identified by the cheap black valise he carried. Worse than the carpetbagger, though, was the scallywag, a betrayer. He was a Southern white Republican who had sold his soul and sold out his race for filthy lucre.
Here's the fucking Pepsi!
Though he did not use the word mongrel, President Johnson was quite familiar with the danger of mongrel citizenship, the very phrase one newspaper used to describe what lay at the heart of Johnson's veto of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Missouri Republican turned Democrat and avid Darwinian Francis Blair Jr. had written the president an impassioned letter against the act just days earlier. He insisted that Congress should never be allowed to inflict on the country a mongrel nation, a nation of bastards. Johnson agreed. At the beginning of his veto message, he highlighted all the new admixtures suddenly protected under the law. The Chinese of the Pacific states, Indians subject to taxation, the people called gypsies, as well as the entire race designated as blacks, people of color, Negroes, mulattoes, and persons of African blood. In granting civil rights, the law removed racial distinctions and opened the door to equal suffrage. Johnson's veto message said that freedmen lacked something naturally endowed, fitness. Finally, the president made clear that he disapproved of any law that sanctioned interracial marriage.
An object believed to have spiritual powers. An object of excessive attention or reverence. Fixation. This is fetish.
Thank you.
righteous social commentators, pride of caste and pride of race were under attack. The old barriers of upholding purity of blood and social exclusiveness eroding as a result of a flurry of Republican legislation. The focus turned to white women. As early as 1867, secret societies began to form, like the Knights of the White Camellia, which first organized in Louisiana. Members swore to marry a white woman, and they agreed to do everything in their power to prevent the production of a bastard and degenerate progeny. In 1868, Francis Blair Jr., the Democratic nominee for vice president, toured the country and made the mongrel threat one of the key issues of the campaign. The next year, Chief Justice Joseph Brown of the Supreme Court of Georgia issued a monumental decision. The former rebel governor ruled that the courts had the right to dissolve all interracial marriages. Amalgamation was classed with incestuous unions and marriages between idiots, which the state already prescribed. By generating sickly and effeminate children, Brown insisted, such abhorrent marriages threatened to drag down the superior race to the level of the inferior. He was repeating the established definition used by animal breeders to categorize a mongrel. Even more telling is Brown's eugenic logic. The state now had the right to regulate breeding in order to prevent contamination of the Anglo-Saxon stock. Still, for Democrats and Republicans alike, race could never be decoupled from class. This was why the scallywag came under venomous verbal attacks and experienced actual physical violence. The scallywag was seen as the glue that held together a fragile Republican coalition of freedmen, transplanted Northerners, Southern Unionists, and converted Confederates. For many Southern Democrats, this white traitor was a more serious obstacle than the carpetbagger, because he was born and bred in the South, and he knew his way around the statehouse. Dismantling the Republican hold over the South demanded the figurative, and at times literal, death of the scallywag.
We obviously started playing here in Mexico. We're Mexicans, we're from Mexico. So our first shows were always here in our home and then just across the country. And I feel like we've seen it grow over the years and how we started and just our crowd, and it makes me so excited that people my age are looking for this energy and like this music specifically. There aren't a lot of female-led rock bands, female like only woman rock bands. So to start working as a young teen, a kid, we didn't even start as women. Like, we started out as little girls in this children. Industry. Children, literally. It involved a lot. And we were doing it with our parents. Like, we were pretty protected. Like, they supported us so much. They got us into lessons. Like, they bought us our instruments. Like, they gave us the liberty to, like, really concentrate. Yeah. On music.
Because imagine you're like just a teenager, maybe 13, and you want to do this. But of course, there's tons of different things that you want to try out and do. So like sticking with it was also hard, you know?
The band started out as a 5-member band. Our parents are part of the band. Right now, obviously, our family has grown a bit more, like with our team, our management, and everyone that works with us. But as we keep on working, that is always like the center of everything, and everyone we start working with starts feeling like family, because we've always had that vibe. To be like disciplined and responsible and like level-headed.
And I
feel like that's really important for the industry that we're in. So a big hug to mom and dad for everything.
What we think really got us into this energetic music and rock and roll was definitely the rock band,
the video game.
We loved to play that game, and it was so fun that we just, like, looked at the screen, and we want to do that. I told my dad, like, I want to play the guitar, and he's like, are you sure? And I was like, of course! By the first week, my fingers hurt so much, and I was like, please, no! But I fell in love with it, and there was no going back. I've been playing for 13 years. I don't like that number, but okay, 13 years. And, well, I've been playing since I was a little kid. I would always play on the drums, like the toy drums. And I remember just, I really liked hitting things. Because it was like a perfect match for me. And my dad saw that I had really good coordination. And he asked me like, hey, are you up for lessons? Like, do you want to give it a shot? And I was like, yeah. Nobody wanted to give me lessons. I looked like a toddler.
I mean,
and,
you
like,
were
I was
six.
Super
were
short. Yeah. Like, playing the drums, it didn't look very... very promising for me, but I met one teacher and I had like a test class, mm-hmm. and the teacher was like, oh, leave her with me. Like she'll be good. Like, let's do this. My parents bought me my first bass, and of course I was really young and really short, and I couldn't play a full-scale bass, so they bought me a smaller bass, which I have right here.
Yeah.
It's really small, and I still couldn't play that, and I learned for about a month, and then we started playing together immediately, so I didn't really have, like, that much time to get used to my instrument before we started playing together.
Okay, wait, but I know that this isn't part of it. I'm going to ask you a question.
I know
this isn't my place, but I will. Because there's a lot of people who tell you, like, why don't you play with a pick? Because normally rock music is just like, from the start,
I always
like
play with my
finger style.
I know how to play with a pick now, and I really do like the sound of it. But I don't know. I just always played with my fingers, and I do feel more comfortable with my fingers, even though I do play more on time with a pick. It's weird. It does hurt more, though, but...
I get it. It's like when I play without shoes and when I play with shoes.
Yeah,
I get it.
In our careers, like, we did our Enter Sandman cover, which went viral, but I feel like the point where we were like, we really want to do this, like, for the rest of our lives, was when we started writing our own music and releasing our own stuff. That was like, whoa, like, we can create something, put it out in the world, and people react to it, which is something that we really, really, like, liked and looked forward to. So now that we're doing what we do today, like, I just feel like it's this thing that really keeps us going, our music. Of course, like, any type of siblings, like, we have our disagreements and our little fights and stuff like that, but we get along really well.
And I know each other so well that we know how to make it work.
Exactly. And in the second that we start writing music, everything just flows really nicely. Like, I don't know what to call it except, like, sibling magic.
Yeah.
Those were our first competitions ever. Mm-hmm. That was our first time writing. I was like 12, Sandy was 14, and I was 9. We were children. But it was the moment where we really fell in love
with music and, like, what we wanted to do. Like, creating something was just such a powerful experience.
And, you know, it was such a key thing, I think, personally, that we were not thinking about will people like it, because we were not going to release it. We were not even going to record it. It was not going to be a thing. So we just literally wrote from our 14-year-old hearts.
Hello.
And then we jumped into our first album, 21st Century Blood. And it was weird because some of the compositions that are in 21st Century Blood were written in the same time as Escape the Mind.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this very big leap we gave with this song that we made called Free Falling.
This was the first song we actually wrote together.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was also a big thing that we started, like, looking for outside inspiration. We really, like, what's happening in the world that we can write about.
And more than anything, like, we read so much and we consume a lot of media, as any Gen Z teen does. So we were constantly getting inspired by other stories that we were hearing. So 21st Century Blood was, like, we felt like it was our first step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, okay, we're a band now. This is our album.
And nothing will change.
Thing that I really like that we do, we really looked for what the song needed. We were like, okay, so what if this is a song with only piano, violins, and stuff like that? Like, we didn't focus on, oh, we have to be rock. We just focused on the energy that went into the song. So if you hear our music, sometimes it will be very varied within the same album.
But then Queen of the Murder Scene comes. It's our second album. And Queen of the Murder Scene, I was in middle school. I started going through my emo phase. So you can hear clearly there how that shift. And, like, I'm angsty now.
These songs and these albums, like, grew with us.
Really,
you can see, like, the change.
Queen of the Murder Scene is a concept album. It tells a story.
A novel.
It was like a novel. And it was a really different process writing songs to fit a narrative and a plot.
It was really hard.
It was hard because we had some, and then we had to add, like, the filler episodes. But we didn't want them to feel like filler songs. So we really had to put meaning into every single little part. But I was, like, really into this idea of making it a whole album about this story.
Yeah.
And when I told them about it, they were like, what?
Why is there blood everywhere?
Why? I was like,
we
had to change so much. Like,
a lot of the storyline, because it wasn't that much
of a storyline.
It was just
murder. Same time,
I was getting
into K-pop.
I just remember that too.
We took the emo face K-pop, like, express line, right?
Yeah.
So you can hear a lot of influences in there that maybe you don't pinpoint them as such, but for us, it's really apparent, like, which phases we were going through.
That key changes to the one.
Those key changes, those harmonies, like, it was all very K-poppy for us.
It's the thing that we also love to do, that as we start learning new ways of doing this, we just, like, okay, what's the next thing that we can try out with our music?
Yeah.
So.
And then in Queen of the Murder Scene, it was key changes.
Yeah.
It was.
Definitely.
Changes
of
key.
That was
the theme.
Things really different now. Because mm-hmm. I feel like we really grew as people.
Even
as
more.
Like, right? Because we're going through our teenage years. Of course, you grow a lot from one year to another. Mm-hmm. And you start living different experiences and stuff like that. So I feel like this third album is personal.
Yeah.
Like, it talks more about our feelings or situations that are close to us or our opinions in certain situations. Evolve was one of the songs that we started writing together, and we had music first before lyrics and melody. It's usually the other way around. So the three of us were in this room.
Yeah,
and Danny
right
and I
here.
Were like playing, like getting the riff. And I was like, let me write a melody really quickly for the verse and just like put some lyrics on there.
I'm not in danger of the danger now.
And I was like, hey, that's a good line.
That's a cool
I'm not in danger, I'm the danger.
That it encases what this new album represents for us, the changes that we went through as musicians, as people, and in writing, because we saw things differently. Like right now we really concentrated on adding a lot of like new harmonies and how like the bass and the drums were going to play together. And then differently at the same time.
Like, there is so much room to grow. And we always enter these situations, like, with big, wondrous eyes. Like, we're going to learn today.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to learn now?
What's going to happen
yeah.
now?
You guys are you. Hey, everybody.
Oye, ¿cómo va? Mi ritmo bueno para gozar. Mulata, oye, ¿cómo va? Mi ritmo, bueno, para gozar. Mulata, pam, 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 pam.
I don't know that song!
Definitely performing our songs live is a totally different universe. Like, we treat it as such, even ourselves. We know it's nothing like recording in a studio. But it's so much fun. You're like directly sharing and expressing to the people who are watching you.
And I feel like our past albums, we try to grab like the sound, like how we sound live into
mm-hmm.
our recordings. And
yeah.
we never really...
But we have never accomplished
we
that.
We never accomplished that until like
this third album.
I've already collapsed, so I'll just drown my soul.
We put in a lot of hard work
yep.
into our
yeah,
live shows. We really planned everything out, and
yep.
we practiced it a lot.
And even our movements, like if you see us playing in our early stages of the band, we're just like statues. And that's something that we actually worked on consciously, like how to play, being able to like jump around and bring more energy to the show.
Like, we make fun of each other while we're on stage.
And I know like I shouldn't really be like saying this, but even when we mess up, we're like, oh, you messed up. Like,
yeah,
like,
we just look at each other like, you messed up.
Country and in our home city, it's just absolutely amazing.
Actually, our last show that we played was in Mexico City, and we hadn't been to Mexico City in a long time.
Yeah.
So coming back and seeing that we had more fans, like there were a lot of people watching us, it was just insane.
It was
one of the
so
best
cool.
shows
people,
we ever
like,
had.
People like screaming our songs. We actually have like a video where you hear everyone singing on top of like it's
yeah,
like
you can't
hear
us.
A big scene
like,
of energetic people
yeah,
ready
people
for
really
metal.
passionate about music in general here in Mexico, and the crowds were always really energetic.
Like, this energy that they transmit, you just can't help but give it back. It's really about making, like, a personal connection of what you want to transmit through your instrument. Because, I look at our past videos, like our covers.
No.
And I'm like, no, what are you doing? But we were so young, we were starting out, so it's okay. But I feel like that's a really nice thing. Looking back and seeing how much you've improved, how much you've grown.
A veces las cosas obvias son las más difíciles de ver. Te asfixiaste con tus propias manos. Cuando todo apunta que por fin alguien te viene a rescatar, te encuentras nuevamente abandonado.
At the end of the day, like, there's a goal, and there's something that you want to reach. And it's really about putting in a lot of work.
And just also be very conscious that the people who work around you are different, you know, are going through different things and will think differently than you. There's no one that will think exactly like you. So taking things with a grain of salt and not taking things personally for it to ruin, like, your experience is a key thing. You know, as sisters, we really have, like, that separate, you know, our working selves and, you know, our sister selves.
Have these stereotypes or these stigmas, like we've seen it in places we've played in festivals and stuff like that. Like, the treatment is really different to, like, other bands, like male bands. But we see that change after, like,
we play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we play, and then, like, people's faces completely change.
Yeah.
And, like, everyone's just so
excited.
Which is
funny to see, because they remind themselves that it doesn't matter who is playing, their age, whatever it is, it's about the music.
Music is the language. It doesn't matter, like, where you're from, like, what language you speak, like, anything. Like, music is
the language.
We're out of the lock, so fight in the air, making it some problems. death. Svetlana is a fake. Maybe they said we are the pussification.
We'll be right back. your face again. My goodness. To break your growing skin. I will break your face off my wall. I will break